Two. Okay, this is side two of session 40, recorded on May 20th, 2007. And I want to just respond to the last words that were on the tape where Scott was saying that Croker in this decade has transcended the chip body concerns. I would say that he has become concerned about the possibilities of genetic alteration, mutation on the chemical body form, so that we end up retrieving the ancient forms of bird and beast and man merged in the same body, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
All right? To the mixture of forms that some primitive cultures, ancient cultures, talked about.
Right.
And he thinks we'll do that. Now, that would be another part of the Paleolithic that McLuhan says we've retrieved,
mm-hmm.
if you believe that cultures were made up of beings like that. Maybe that'd be pre-Paleolithic.
Yeah, one of the myths of Atlantis was that they were doing that kind of stuff, and that's why they got so out of balance that they crashed.
Right. Okay, so we've got that. Now, where do we want to go into now, talking about Croker? Oh, yeah, I think I wanted to say this. So when Ken Wilber brings in the astral and the emotional bodies, or these references to the suprahuman or another dimension, that's his ground that he's thinking in terms. He's saying that the three-brain model can be matched up to a deeper ground that we survive this existence and live in another dimension, and the bodies from that dimension are imposed on our secular models. That's thinking that way is what I mean by the Thompson quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
That it's accepted. It's an assumption that there's something more than this form.
Right. Well, Wilber's model is designed such that if you look at it from one perspective, the brain creates consciousness, and if you look at it from another perspective, consciousness is channeled through the brain. So
he doesn't stand on one side or the other?
No, he says you can look at it from both sides of the mirror, and that's good to be able to do that.
And what does that lead to, being able to do that?
I only read a little bit of his book, and actually I don't want to try to misinterpret him or misquote him. But my thing is, see, he divides a person into four quadrants. You have a subjective self and an objective self. You know, your inner sense of self, which corresponds to your brain and your body and your physicality, and then you also have a sense of internal sense of we and an external sense of the collective we, and so you have these four parts of yourself, and so you know there's the separate self and the objective self, and then the internal collective. You know, we, and then the external collective we, which is made up of media, it's made up of a cultural and social matrix.
So that relates to the schizophrenic effect of the McLuhan quadrant that I have in my chart, because since we live in a post-literate, post-media, in a strange new situation, you know, since the satellite environment, where we're not really limited to any one culture, then someone like Wilber can come along and sit on in the interval, in the gap.
Yeah.
He's still talking about his self. That's a bit of a legacy. He's still talking about a we, the media meme effect, and he interplays in between them, and that's the tactility. And he's accepted today in that way of processing information, because he's a reflex of the discarnate state that McLuhan's talking about. So what were we going to say?
I just wanted to be a little more concise, you know, because he sees you as being four parts. You have an I and a mine, and then you have a we and a ours. So
That's sort of like a limited quadriphenia.
Yeah.
He's taking two doubles. The doubleness of your inner self and your outer self around the idea of a consciousness of self, and then your collective media environment, social environments you have to interact with, which is both a we and an ours.
Right.
So, but he'd be a subset of Quadrophenia, limited to the McLuhan, to the Croker and Thompson effects, limited Croker, but unaware of the media condition that McLuhan talks about that creates his sense of self and we.
Mm-hmm.
So he's an acceptable schizophrenic.
Yeah, well, he's aware of fundamentally what underlies all of that is this, it's something that is not I or we, it's not mine or ours, it's this Buddhic sort of...
There's your astral body tradition, what I call the astral body or the impulse that there's something more.
Yeah, but it transcends the astral body, which is still in form, even though it's mutable form. It's in the model of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. It's the deep sleep aspect. Formless aspect of the self where, you know, you can't see your own eye in the mirror, so you can never really see who's doing the looking, but the ground is the thing that's doing the looking.
Yeah, and I would call that the Thompson quadrant, which deals with that there's more than the sensory life. If you're a deep sleep, you're not sensing it.
Well, you can learn to if you're a yogi. That's the whole point.
Ah, so he's heading towards yogi consciousness, which is another assumption that you get to a point of being able to become conscious of that.
See, the eye that's looking that you can never actually see is either possibly the mystery body or McLuhan's private citadel of consciousness.
Right. But sticking within his assumptions, they are grounded in the idea there's more than what is apparent.
Mm-hmm.
That's why he's not Aristotelian. He's slightly platonic, but he goes into a Buddhist sensibility, which may or may not be Plato's esoteric tradition.
Yeah.
I don't know if people see Plato as a deep yogi.
Right.
So, but the assumption that there's more is what I call the spiritual, religious, astral tradition in cultures.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan sneaks in and says, maybe it's just an effect of the pre-writing and then the writing.
Nah, all four of your guys think that there's that something extra, that something more.
Do you think that?
Well, I don't know about Croker. I don't know about Croker, but the other guys do.
Yeah, the Croker, he thinks it's the creative impulse, and he might not categorize it.
Yeah, that would be a Nietzsche. That would be a Nietzsche. That would come from his Nietzsche devotion.
Yeah, there's something in the human, a stubbornness or something that in a sense, transcends... the limitations around us, the determined environments.
Yeah.
So, but I think he is pretending to say that not even that will work. That it is the end for the human.
Mm.
And maybe he thinks that we would become part of the machinic, and we would somehow experience that. So the experiencer of the human flesh.
Well, you know, you have these guys like, what, Negroponte? Is that the guy who talks about downloading your brain into a chip?
No, that's Moravec.
Hans Moravec, yeah. So maybe Croker thinks that's already happened.
Yes, yeah. And so he may think that there's an experiencer that had the human phase and will continue to experience the machinic, but in a very bizarre way in... The humans wouldn't think that they survived it.
Yeah.
Unless Croker is an out-and-out anarchist or revolutionary who wants to destroy the system. But he doesn't...
Well, one of his lines of thinking, which isn't in your book here, but it was in the conversation when you interviewed him on Evan Ray's show, where he talks about how the United States was founded on the Puritan ethic, the ancient belief in Jehovah... interfacing postmodern technology. So you have the most ancient and the most postmodern merging and creating the seamless and Neolithic environment that we have now, where the media is miming the Neolithic guy throwing cavemen rocks at each other, like you say.
That's Paleolithic.
Paleolithic.
Neolithic is agricultural.
Yeah, paleo. Okay, Paleolithic, yeah.
But the point you're saying there, what were you just saying about Croker, that...
Well, you know, the guys...
Oh, yeah, the Puritan. So I wanted to say this. So he does... Since the 80s, he says that St. Augustine describes the postmodern environment.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be hard for people to figure out how 400 AD is like the postmodern today. So he continues that tradition in saying that the Puritans retrieved this ancient sensibility, but it's ancient in terms of Christian. It doesn't go back to Mesopotamian or pre-Christian. So he's talking about the Christian bias.
Well, no, I think he's talking pre-Christian, because when Jehovah's Old Testament, and he's talking
about Christian. Well, I guess that's Hebrew, right? Okay.
Yeah. And
so
he's still
dealing with the literate then.
But in terms of, I don't know if he's implying the android meme, but he's saying, but we're quantum, because in quantum you have these tunneling effects where the past can tunnel into the future, and that's what he's saying is happening. Jehovah from 5,000 years ago is tunneling into 5,000 years in the future when, you know, everything is post-human technology.
Right. He's still talking about a literate sensibility, because the Old Testament is based on manuscript or writing, right?
Yeah. And then he also talks about some kind of flipping going on there quantum dynamics.
It's a dialectical flattening of McLuhan's tetrad, that every new environment retrieves something from way back that's been forgotten. Mm-hmm. So that, from McLuhan's point of view, the Puritan sensibility that the Bush administration represents is something retrieved due to our present technological matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But Croker keeps it on the dialectical materialist level, and using Baudrillard's paradigm or the strategy of taking the latest scientific models and applying them to sociology, the quantum tunneling is particle and wave or wavicle, two things interacting and retrieving, or not even retrieving. Yeah, it's retrieved, but it's within a dialectical situation. We have a new post-2000 situation, and then the Jehovah Old Testament really tunnels back in. That's only two parts of the tetrad from McLuhan's point of view. You know what I mean? He's only emphasizing the retrieval.
Does Croker like Hegel?
I don't think so. I mean, he...
Because Hegel had his own dialectic thing, which is largely misunderstood.
Right. Well, he's a student of Marx, and Marx comes out of Hegel, so to the degree that he finds Marx useful, then maybe Hegel is embedded in there.
Right.
But the Hegelian Marxist tradition is part of what he dances on the toes of, you know, so...
Yeah, describe that, exactly... When you say dances on the toes, I always think of, like, there's this giant monolithic being, and then you have the Croker or the McLuhan or whatever dancing on the toes of that monster, but I don't know what you mean by that.
McLuhan once said that all we can do today is dance on each other's toes. Because we're all inside this seamless membrane. We're all in the same space. We're all super angels. And therefore, we're in this tactile interplay, tactile modulation. And therefore, we can only tickle each other. One form of tickling is maybe dancing.
Mm-hmm.
That's a way of... it's like angels dancing on the head of a pin.
Right?
So I say that taking that as an assumption of anybody in the information environment, that's a given. Then Thompson dances on the Buddhist meme, pushes it further. Croker dances on the Marxist meme, or tradition. And McLuhan dances on the Catholic meme. And Luce dances on the scientific or technological liberalist meme. And they push it and expand it and raise new questions that the recognized establishment members of the meme aren't noticing.
And
so it's a way of bugging
people. If they tickle the meme, then there's even a little sense of humor there.
Yeah, and they are satirizing.
Do you guys see these guys as having senses of humor?
They all do.
They all have a predominant sense of humor.
Well, everybody in our situation is a manipulating satirist.
Yeah.
So they are manipulating satirists, but they're good at it.
That means tongue-in-cheek sense of humor.
Satire?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's if you think of it as tongue-in-cheek, but they recognize the inherent tragedy and comedy of the situation.
Right.
So that
being manipian is a way of slightly standing outside of the structure and keeping yourself a little bit sane by not merging with it.
Right. And so they have...
Although Croker says that you can't really stand outside the structure in order to critique it. You have to engage the structure and then wrestle with it, I think.
Which is an updated McLuhan. Very much what Croker does is similar to McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
He's more McLuhanist than anybody else in the postmodern scene, but he doesn't have the ideology, what he perceives as the ideology of McLuhan, which is too embedded in the human tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taking a McLuhan strategy in relation to the post-human.
Yeah, so he thinks that McLuhan is still propping up the anthropomorphic too much.
No, the anthropomorphic is always there. Everybody, it's just the human ability, the human instinct to create an environment that it thinks it is.
That conforms to the human animal.
No. It's anthropomorphic just to experience the post-human is anthropomorphic because you're projecting that's what it is. That's what the environment is.
Right.
And that you're part of it and maybe not completely it.
Right.
I don't know what Coker would say are bees.
But when you anthropomorphize an animal, you're projecting that it has some kind of like human sensibility that it can relate to you, and
yeah,
you can relate to it.
And I don't mean that exactly. That's included, but I'm making a very broad instinct when I say the anthropomorphic physical is it's the human perception of existence as something human and maybe.
But there's a way of relating it back to itself and saying, oh yeah, that's just. I can see that. I can, you know, like the alchemists used to talk about Adam Kadmon. They said, well, we can fit all the parts of the cosmos into all the different parts of the human frame or human form and then just see it as being, you know, everything is a mirror of the human form, which is what God originally created. So it's all anthropomorphic.
Yeah, and that would be maybe the self-reflexive, the being conscious of it ourselves and thinking that we're conscious of something that isn't conscious of itself.
Yeah,
that dilemma is the human condition, and that's the anthropomorphic physical.
Yeah.
So, what did you say? You said McLuhan. I'm just saying McLuhan. He thought the human form was always there, and that the discarnate state was not post-human. He would say it's post-chemical body, but not post-human because it was part of the human.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extension of us.
Extension of the human.
Yeah, it is.
But like I said earlier, it maybe disappeared the soul which had developed from the visual space development of bringing in the vowels.
That's why he danced on the Catholic Church, because he says as long as we have television, there's no foundation for the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have to turn off TV. He raised the question if our soul was built on the phonetic alphabet or the Catholic sense of soul.
Yeah, it obsolesces it, but it doesn't disappear. I mean, people still turn off their TV and go to church on Sunday, read their Bibles, and still believe all that stuff.
Right, and then they took over politics, and everybody, the whole world got mad at them.
Yeah.
So they're not fully understanding the situation, perhaps, because they still think there's a reality to that old literate meme.
Yeah.
And they don't recognize there isn't any. So the whole discarnate android meme population yells at Bush and the fundamentalists.
Yeah, and they're just a reflexive response to the Islamic fundamentalist. They both arose together at the same time.
Yeah, they're both retrieving visual space.
They're both Paleolithic.
The Islamic Muslim revolution is in reaction to the coming virtual space that they don't think they've totally succumbed to, and the Western fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, are a reaction after going through the virtual chip body space.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying? One is trying to hold it off, and the other is trying to rebuild something after being wiped out by the chip body.
Right.
Or the chip landscape, we'll say.
Yeah. And so it's all being, the whole war is being fought on a misunderstanding. If these guys knew how to talk about what you're talking about with each other, they could come to an agreement that they're both facing the same problem and work together.
Right. And now McLuhan says it's a natural human instinct, and he even speculates this could be what original sin is that humans never can live in the present. They just can't.
Mm-hmm.
And they always live in the past, in the rearview mirror. So people are not going to recognize what he's warning us about. That's why he kind of advocates, just as we allow an elite to manage the economy through the interest rate and all that, we should have an elite that protects humans from their own ignorance, since they can't see the present, are going to get themselves in more and more trouble, manage the media environment, turn off TV, present an environment of just radio and newspapers for a while, then turn them off and bring on television as a counter to that. And that was his strategy. But that was when there was a difference between those media environments.
Yeah. Didn't you say once that the Evergreen said that human beings will always be at war? That's just an intrinsic part of this physical world.
Yeah, the Evergreens channel through Michael Blake Reed said, and there's 6,500 to 7,000 entities, in case someone didn't notice us talking about them before, they said that war will not end. Didn't say we'd always have war, but sound like we're going to have it for a long time, including the final Armageddon is in 500 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
So Croker, is there anything you've read? Did I explain what he's doing now? He's worried about the mutation of the human form. So,
well, between where he's at now and what you were writing in your book, Phatic Communion, with Bob Dobbs in the 90s, the later period in between here, he wrote Data Trash. I think that's noteworthy that, you know, actually be interesting if we read a little bit of that text in order to get the flavor of exactly, you know, how much he thought the machine took over, because he's talking as though he's already been possessed by the machine and he doesn't even exist anymore. And it's just the machine that's writing, the computer's just writing text down for him.
Yeah. When I say that McLuhan, his books represent what a book would write, they're not McLuhan's opinion. The books wrote Understanding Media and Gutenberg Galaxy.
Yeah.
Croker is saying that the Android Meme writes the Panic Encyclopedia and the Data Trash.
Right.
Do you have
that book there?
No, it's in another room. I couldn't get it right now.
Okay.
I don't want to get that. We can just say it's a theory of the virtual class. That's the subtitle, Data Trash, of that book. And it's like a manifesto for the working man that Marx and Engels created.
Yeah.
It's an updating of class warfare. But it's dealing with the effect of simulation and post-simulation.
The virtual class has no geographical boundaries. Does it have members? I mean, how do you even define a virtual?
He says there are humans or chemical bodies in it, but they're dupes and transitory implementation of the Android meme.
Yeah.
So the Android meme, has no recognizable human features.
The virtual class, the virtual is a simulacrum. It has no substance.
Right, and it's post-simulacrum. It's something that's taken, it's not simulating us or simulating anything that we recognize. It's taken on a life of its own and become anamorphic.
Yeah. So that's how he goes beyond, where Baudrillard was, I guess. In that.
Yeah, and he did try to go past Baudrillard in the late 80s and early 90s with his bimodernism and other things. But later, Baudrillard
leapfrogged Croker.
Yeah, or caught up to that, if you would agree that Croker went past Baudrillard.
Mm-hmm.
But Baudrillard kept it in simple terms. It's not as Baroque in writing style as Croker developed.
I tried to read Perfect Crime, and it's pretty Baroque.
Right. But once you get it, it's pretty straightforward and it repeats himself, whereas I find most people haven't got a clue when they read Croker.
Uh-huh.
I mean, have you gotten better at reading Croker since we've talked about him?
Oh, sure. Of course. I mean, I've had, you know, the consummate introduction as to what he's about from Bob.
Yes. So the theory of the virtual class is interesting. It's a it's trying to adopt a political or critical tradition, or updating the critical tradition in relation to something that's pretty difficult to criticize, since it's post-human.
Now, I've never seen the Panic Encyclopedia. Does it look like an encyclopedia with entries and definitions and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And so he's got like 100 different entries or something? And then a little paragraph about each one, and basically saying essentially the same thing about everything. I mean, once you get the idea, you probably don't have to keep reading it.
Like with McLuhan, and like LaRouche, and like Thompson, they all impose a formula on their experience.
Right.
And McLuhan described this back. back in the 50s as what scientists do, that the 20th century magician slash scientist is someone who creates a formula. Mm-hmm. So McLuhan satirized that while creating not just a funny model, but a viable model.
Right.
That swallowed the assumptions of the 20th century scientists. Like, he thinks that James Joyce came up with a way better, quote, unquote, science than Einstein.
Who does?
McLuhan.
Oh, yeah.
And that Einstein was a tiger compared to Joyce, because Joyce was dealing with the effects of technologies that were coming indefinitely, whereas Einstein ended up just paralyzed the fact that he created one problem, the atomic bomb, and never got over it.
Yeah.
And sort of didn't come up with a strategy of dealing with the effects of it, just sort of worried about it.
Yeah.
Whereas Joyce, McLuhan claims...
But the guy who creates technology wins, because nobody's ever heard of Joyce except a few people, or nobody knows what Joyce did, and everybody knows what Einstein did.
But they might have heard of McLuhan, and McLuhan might have updated Joyce, though Joyce and scholars wouldn't agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Though what's interesting, the rumors are that Joyce's grandson, Stephen Joyce, has said that Eric's PhD on Finnegan's Wake finally cracks the code on Finnegan's Wake. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But a lot of scholars argue and don't trust Stephen Joyce because he's such a problem for them getting access to Joyce's estate materials.
Oh.
And just the same way, the McLuhan family is very protective of the materials, supposedly. That's what people say, claim. That Stephen Joyce and Eric McLuhan became allies because they're in the same boat, trying to protect their father's works or grandfather's work.
Have they met or spoken?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But something I should look into at some point.
Right.
So how do we get on to that?
So Croker, in your Shakespeare...
Oh, you were saying about Joyce and Einstein. Yeah.
Yeah.
So no one knows about Joyce.
And nobody knows what Joyce did, but Einstein... for better or for worse, has drastically impacted history.
Or he didn't. The bomb has come and gone, and only certain vested interests keep that meme going, as if we should be afraid of it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Internet creates a whole sensibility that doesn't believe any of the warnings about post-911 age of terror.
Yeah.
But that's the ambivalence we live in, and ambivalence is what people more and more recognize, and that's what Joyce expressed in Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
The ambivalence of humans relating to art, science, nature, and technology, and cognition, and folklore, and daily life.
Mm-hmm. So why is Hamlet associated with Croker on your chart?
Well, if we're in a post-human situation, then for the human person, it's pretty paralyzing.
To be or not to be.
Right, but I'm thinking of Hamlet as a character who couldn't really make a decision, remained in the world of indecision, and suffered the consequences.
Yeah.
And I see Croker expressing the Generation X dilemma.
Yeah.
That they, at least the projected media mood was that they were incapable of coming up with something after the baby boomers.
Yeah.
So... But they eventually created the dot-com revolution, so they might be considered part of the generation of that, even though a lot of baby boomers like Bill Gates and them were part of it, so maybe that doesn't work, that pattern. But the basic postmodern condition of being paralyzed by so many options and so many cultural conflicts, I see that as the condition of Hamlet, which the baby boomers did not perceive at first. They eventually, by the 80s, had to deal with that. But in the 50s and 60s, they had a sense of action and possibility, what was called the human potential movement and all the political revolutions that were propagated. Generation X didn't feel that.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that pretty well that something had won that they couldn't bypass.
Yeah.
But that was before the supposed autonomy-creating effect of the digital revolution of the dot-com world.
Yeah. What's the source of the panic that, you know, I mean, God, he wrote the whole book, Panic Encyclopedia. Panic is when you think you're about to get annihilated by something bigger than you. I mean, isn't that what causes panic to happen?
Yeah, that's why I see the 80s croaker as dealing with the pre-dot-com world. He's dealing with the last gasp of the cloning of ESP, which is bigger than humans.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much an interactive, sensitive environment to the chemical body, it's crushing major media paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And that was supposedly bypassed with the new space the chip body created.
Mm-hmm. So he saw panic as being the mood of this technological revolution.
Yeah, McLuhan talks about when a new technology comes in as an environment, there's alarm, resistance, and exhaustion. I think that's what the three phases.
Right.
Alarm, resistance, and then not able to stop it. Exhaustion. And then boredom sets in. Now, Croker says we're in a boredom culture now. That's what his latest term is.
Mm.
A culture of boredom. The panic part could be, Croker throws in panic. You don't have the word panic in the alarm, resistance, exhaustion cycle, but panic could be a distillation of all three. Because
mm-hmm.
panic can be frozen as well as hyperactive.
Right.
So, Croker, homeopathically,
panic probably flips into hysteria.
No, that would be included. And that would be alarm.
Mm-hmm.
In McLuhan's terms, but the condensation of alarm, resistance, and exhaustion.
I mean, I just remember this show when I was a kid. It was The Mummy, and this archaeologist is working inside the pyramid, and all of a sudden this mummy comes alive. At first he's terrified and he's freaking out and screaming, the whole thing is. His panic flips into hysteria, and he starts laughs himself to death because the whole thing is just too weird.
And he dies?
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be exhaustion, maybe.
Yeah.
But I was saying that alarm, resistance, exhaustion gets compressed holopathically into the word panic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have on the chart, I have paranoia, schizophrenia, hysteria, panic, and ecstasy. And they could be interchangeable, but not completely.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that panic is Croker's replay of the McLuhan cycle
mm-hmm.
of alarm, resistance, exhaustion, and boredom.
Mm. So how does Bouderoth express himself when he catches up with Croker?
Oh, he starts talking about he talks about the post-simulation situation.
Mm-hmm.
You probably see that in the Perfect Crime book, which was written in the middle 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But I've noted it in his book since then, many different books. He points that out. He calls the new situation, his latest phrase is integral reality.
Mm.
Integral or integral reality.
Right.
That means like totally merged and there's no divisions.
Yeah, that's another Ken Wilber term. And, you know, he's... looking at the integral merging of the four quadrants that I laid out that I told you later.
And he sees that as a creative act.
Yeah.
And that's puts him in the Thompson quadrant, whereas Baudrillard sees an obliterating post-human normal situation when he says integral or integral reality.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He may have already meant that. Mm-hmm. But he began in the 80s talking about simulation, and you know, start off with the recognizable state, but was ready to move it to the post-simulation once he'd established the simulation meme.
Right. Who are the other French postmodernists that would fall into the Croker-Baudrillard category, if any?
Oh, yeah, no, there's Virilio,
mm-hmm.
V-I-R-I-L-I-O. There's... Foucault, F-O-U-C-A-U-L-T. Then these two writers, Deleuze and Guattari. Deleuze is D-E-L-E-U-Z-E.
Mm-hmm.
And Guattari. Guattari is Guattari.
Right. And what if they're all sort of say, are they all saying the same thing, or what distinguishes all these guys?
Well, he did a book called The Possessed Individual in 91 or so.
Who did?
Where he does a long essay on each one of them. On Baudrillard, Virilio, Deleuze and Guattari, Foucault, Roland Barthes, Barthes, and an art critic, art establishment guy named Lyotard.
Mm-hmm.
Did I spell Barthes? Barthes.
Okay.
And Lyotard is Lyotard, so I think we've got seven there.
Right.
Eight, if you think of Deleuze and Guattari as two people.
And Foucault was an anthropologist or an archaeologist?
He was a criminologist, sociologist. He did a book on the archaeology of knowledge. He was a philosopher who ransacked all kinds of disciplines.
Right.
Psychiatry, prisons.
Mm.
All over the place. But so you could say a sociologist, maybe.
Mm.
Philosophical sociologist. And kind of a political activist.
So what does Kroeker say about all these guys? Did they all distinguish themselves in some unique way?
Yeah, he says the essay at the beginning of the book, The Possessed Individual, is a justification, an explanation of why these French thinkers were so relevant to the 80s and 90s, or maybe even the 70s. He celebrates them as being in a unique position in France to look at the American technological dynamo.
Right.
And
now these guys come after the existentialist movement.
Yeah, yeah.
And are they part of the semiotic, or do they come after semiotic?
Semiotics is Barthes.
Okay.
Barthes, Roland Barthes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, there's all these different schools, and he says the debates among them, represented by these seven major figures, said and created a very stimulating intellectual or critical environment that was the best scene, produced the best thinkers in dealing with the American dynamo, and because they were outside of it. It's like McLuhan used to say, the Canadians can see the American environment because they're not totally in it, but they're close to it.
Right.
So the French are, the French gang that Kroeker writes about are well qualified to create original perspectives on what we in North America and the rest of the world were going through.
See, if I remember correctly, Foucault, unlike some of these other guys, tried to argue that visual space, the written word, was actually more primary than the spoken word.
That's Derrida.
Derrida.
D-E-R-R-I-D-A.
Right.
And he's someone that Kroeker doesn't write on.
He thought that it was the written word that shaped the way we use the spoken word, not the other way around, but then other guys would argue the reverse.
Right. Some people would say Derrida was being manipulative and perverse and was influenced by McLuhan. He did comment on McLuhan in the early 70s. And see, what's interesting, Kroeker, as a McLuhan scholar or student, was interested in how McLuhan created these seven guys. They all responded to McLuhan.
Mm.
They all were reaction to what McLuhan had created because, you know, in the French vocabulary of the late 60s, they coined a word, McLuhanism. McLuhanism.
Mm.
Not many other, I don't think any other cultures did that. So they have an actual word for the McLuhan effect, and it basically got strong in 67 when there was the Expo 67 in Montreal, which was in the French-Canadian province of Quebec. And so there was much activity between Paris and Quebec in that period, and so that is when these people that we're just talking about heard a lot about McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've done a long essay showing how each one of them, in quotes, ripped off McLuhan or restated McLuhan in a limited specialist, fragmented way, and that anything they came up with, McLuhan already did. I mean, Foucault is known for pointing out, when I said he was a political activist, he was a unique political activist because he said reacting to the political problems of the day and confronting the legislatures and political parties only keeps those guys going, and it's not the way to do a political life anymore. And a lot of them reacting to the collapse of whatever they thought was going on in May 68 with the attempted revolution in May 68 in Paris and across the country that failed and de Gaulle reestablished authority. They also, around the late 60s, were experiencing Joyce. James Joyce was being translated for the first time. So a lot of these people were exploring Joyce, and Don Thiel says that some of them got interested in McLuhan because he talked about Joyce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what attracted them to McLuhan. Mm. So this long essay that I have on my archives at fivebody.com/project, it's called Literate Aesthetic Cliché Probes in the American Classroom Without Walls. I think that's what the full title is. I go through all of these people plus others and show how they were replaying holyopathically aspects of McLuhan.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, so I was saying that the idea that Foucault saying we've got to be careful in our political activism how we generate resistance because we'll just give credibility to the thing we're against, and it has no credibility in the simulated information world anyway, so just ignore it. McLuhan writes about that kind of strategy back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if any Foucault students know that.
Yeah. What's interesting, I was reading ahead to LaRouche, which we'll get to next week, and he was talking about how...
See, LaRouche's strategy is what Foucault would be...
He's talking about how the...
LaRouche's strategy is exactly what Foucault recommended against. All right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
Carry on with what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, he's talking about how the secret intelligence get, like, the popular media to run cover for them by doing exposés on secret intelligent scenarios that could be happening, which actually cause people to think that there is something going on, but it's a bait which throws the scent off and throws them in the wrong direction.
Right. Now, that's slightly Foucauldian, and it's pointing out how the political activities are red herrings. But LaRouche still believes in interacting with the political tradition and reforming it.
Yeah.
Whereas Foucault, he doesn't go as extreme as Croker and say it's post-human, but he says those establishments aren't even worth resuscitating.
They're totally ineffectual. Well, what does he think is the organizing the world around us as if it's not the political world?
I think it was freedom, liberation of expression. I mean, Foucault was apparently homosexual. He died of AIDS, and he was very influential in the rise of gay culture in the 70s. So I think he represented individual human autonomy, maybe a kind of anarchy.
Yeah.
But an informed anarchy that did not follow any of the normal traditions of 19th century and early 20th century taboos.
Yeah. It sounds like you see McLuhan as being the emperor, and then these guys are all spin-offs, effective or ineffectual to one degree or another, and then you have Croker who comes in and sort of establishes the next octave.
Yeah, well, I don't want to identify with any of them. You know, LaRouche may be right that we need a person like him in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
I find it hard to commit myself to that kind
of... Well, but, you know, a person like LaRouche in the White House at what phase in the, you know, because... He, you know, his ability to be effectual would have been different in the clone DSP, would have been different in the voluntary BSP, would have been different in the post-Android meme. I mean, when do you think LaRouche might have been effective as president? Because I don't think he could be effective in all those different possibilities.
Well, if money, as some people think, is the ground of everything, and he took over the banking operations,
yeah,
dismantled the Federal Reserve, then maybe he could establish a human flesh control of the world economy and move it towards industry. You look at the way people are in terms of zonked out on software entertainment, yeah, and ain't there thinking about making machine tools. If he could modulate the environment, that might be a progression. And he does advocate cold fusion. He does talk about moving forward, which is what I think is important, using the new frictionless energy systems.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that in this world of communication, I go past Croker, Thompson, McLuhan, and LaRouche and say even the Android meme has succumbed.
Mm-hmm.
That movement by machines or technology taking on a life of its own has run its course.
Mm-hmm.
So I push the envelope even further. And what do I see as breaking us out of that is the frictionless energy systems.
Mm-hmm.
Croker would see the frictionless energy systems as within the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
Just allow it to move more efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't identify with LaRouche's program because I think of McLuhan. I don't identify with McLuhan's program because I think of Thompson. I don't identify with Thompson's program because I think of Croker. And I don't identify with Croker's program because I think of the breakthrough that I intuited.
Yeah. But all these people have influenced probably several thousand other people, even though they've been ineffectual in terms of changing the world. And you've probably influenced a handful of people. So you're the least effective of all of them, even though you've got the right idea.
Yeah, but I've influenced the world in a lot of ways. I mean, going back to the McCarthy era, the Kennedy assassination, Watergate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Remember on my chart, those political movements